You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org. Today's event is Legislating Network Neutrality. Is it necessary?
All right, folks, why don't we just get this thing going, if we may. I know everybody's still leaving. The potato chips are very loud. Don't worry about it. I'm sorry about the tight quarters, but there seems to be some kind of interest in this issue. And it's a small room, but it's very centrally located between the House and Senate. So we're very happy about that. My name is Tim Lorden. I'm with the Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, and we do, for the past decade, we've been doing event programming for the Congressional Internet Caucus on relevant issues. It's been 10 years since our first panel briefing like this on broadband, which was back in 1997. The Internet Caucus had its first discussion of broadband deployment. So we've been looking at this issue for a while now. Since then, a lot has happened. In January, what we do is the advisory committee consists of corporations, trade associations, public interest groups, nonprofits, consumer groups, and we get together as a group to kind of plan what the relevant topics are for discussion for that Congress really needs to be looking at. You obviously didn't need us to tell you that net neutrality is an important one, but nevertheless, we got together as a group and kind of planned a four-person panel and what the relevant perspectives would be for the panel. It was funny that half of the membership came at it from a perspective of just recently there were two regulatory and legal decisions that they felt had removed some certain principles governing access to the Internet that they thought should be preserved. The other half of the group felt that there were some bills starting to percolate in Congress that would bolt on or map on significant regulation to the Internet that hadn't existed before. So the groups came at it from different perspectives. And what we decided to do was not make any judgments about which perspective was correct, but to have a discussion about that. Last year, let's how this issue came to the fore for us last year, about in March of last year, we had a briefing on VoIP port blocking, and it was just about a month after the Federal Communications Commission had settled a problem with a phone company in rural, I guess it was North Carolina, I might think it was, called Madison River, where they were blocking the ports of a VoIP phone service that operated over the Internet. The FCC stepped in very quickly, a five-page consent order, and for 30 months, that problem is solved. We had a discussion about that just shortly thereafter. But in that time, many bills have been introduced. I think as we stand here today, we have about over half a dozen bills, probably more if you really wanted to expand your definition. Just a few of them are, we have the Barton Rush bill in the House Commerce Committee. I think that's called COPE, is that right? The COPE bill? We have the Markey bill, or the would-be Markey amendment to that COPE bill, which is actually, I think it's H.R. 5273. We have the House Judiciary Committee's bill by Sensenbrenner, Conyers, and even Congressman Bauscher, who is our caucus co-chair for the Internet Caucus, who just got married, by the way, this week, if anybody didn't hear that. Congressman Bauscher got married. Congratulations. We also have Senator Stevens has a bill in the Senate Commerce Committee. Senator Snow and Dorgan have their own Senate Commerce Committee bill, as does Senator Ensign and another bill by Senator Wyden. So there's quite a bit of legislation out there. And also, as you may notice, the title of this panel is Legislating Network Neutrality Necessary? And a very real option here is, Is this legislation not needed at all? Is there not a problem? If there are problems down the road, like there was with Madison River, is there existing legal, common law, statutory authority sufficient to address it? That's kind of my opening. I think the question is, what's at stake? I'm not going to wax poetic because we really don't have the time. But Senator Allen said in the hearing, and he said it actually quite a few times, that the Internet is one of the most important developments or phenomena since the invention of the Gutenberg press. Lee Rainey at the Pew Internet and American Life Project likes to tell a story about a book he's read, detailing the 200 years after the development of the Gutenberg press. Apparently, what was the vast majority of stuff that was printed in the two centuries after the Gutenberg press were like black magic and hocus pocus spells. It really didn't. There was nothing any substantive that came out of the Gutenberg press for years, with the exception of the Bible, which is a big one, no question. Generally, everything else is all black magic and hocus pocus. The internet, it's in the past 20 years, and even in the last 10 years that we've even been having broadband to the home, has transmogrified every aspect of commerce, of communications. It is quite possibly the greatest tool for free speech ever developed. So there is a lot at stake, no matter which way you come at this discussion. The format for today, we have four expert panelists. I think you probably all should know them. If you don't, their email addresses are in the little folder that we have, so feel free to email them and get to know them. They're all experts on this issue. What we'll do is I'll start off with asking them some moderated questions. We're not going to have any like opening statements or anything like that. We're just going to have moderated questions at the beginning. Very quickly, I'll open up to questions from you, because I think it's more important what you think and the questions that you have rather than the questions that I have. And people have been giving me questions for the past week that I'd be happy to ask. But be prepared for questions. When you do ask a question, I'm just going to repeat it into the microphone, not to be redundant, but just because it'll be webcast and podcast after the event, as we do with all of our events. So I think just one last piece of housekeeping. We passed out one-pagers. Everybody should have gotten them. What we did, we solicited from our entire membership of the Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, 200 organizations, to send us one-pagers on this issue, on this very question. So we got over a dozen of really good ones, maybe even close to two dozen, really good one-pagers that may help you as you kind of parse through this issue and see where everybody is. And then we also have given you a list of our upcoming events throughout the summer. It's not an exhaustive list, but it'll give you a preview of what's coming up. So let me introduce the panelists in turn, in no particular order. Gigi Sohn from Public Knowledge, which is a public interest group here in Washington. We're focusing on a lot of different issues, including intellectual property, but also now net neutrality. Greg Rothschild, Vice President from Verizon Communications. I think everybody actually may have been aware of Greg when he worked on the House just until recently. Chris Libertelli, formerly of the Federal Communications Commission, now with Skype. Chris worked for Chairman Powell and I think wrote the Powell-Libertelli Four Freedoms back in the day. And of course, not last but not least, Mike Schuller, Deputy General Counsel for the National Cable and Telecommunications Association. So I guess I'm just going to start off with questions, if I may, if that's fine, rather than just going into statements. I think the question that I've been reading, a lot of people have asked me is, I've mentioned Madison River, which happened in about February. Well, it didn't happen in February last year, but it got addressed in February of last year. Where are the examples of bad behavior? What are the bad behavior that we're concerned about now and possibly in the future? And let me take one pagers, just because it's in alphabetical order. AT&T is the first one. They start off in their first page on their one pager with a quote from their chairman saying, you know, we're just not going to block packets or anything like that. And I think the question here today is it blocking? Discrimination, prioritization, that's an important question that we're talking about with regard to net neutrality. And I guess the question is, what's the bad behavior that we're really, really concerned about here? I see Gigi raising her hand, so.
The bad behavior we're concerned about here is discrimination. I mean, plain and simple. What we don't want the telephone companies and the cable companies to do, because they own 98% of the broadband pipes in the home of this country, is to favor certain content applications and services in which they have a financial interest. Now, clearly, we are concerned about blocking. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, and that's the easy one, right? You know, the Madison River case is the easy case. All the companies pledged they'll never do it again. So obviously you're concerned about blocking, but you know that's not going to be the scenario. That's going to be the easiest scenario to catch, and the one that you know everybody's going to go crazy over. Which is harder to catch, and really more troublesome, is the case where perhaps you know your Vonage service is slowed up a bit because a telephone company or a cable company has its own voice over internet protocol service that they would like to favor.
And would that be degrading? Would that be a degradation?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. Okay. Particularly if you're doing it, you know, for competitive reasons. But I want to get to the nub of the argument that this is a solution in search of a problem. I think part of the problem is that we're not defining the word problem correctly. The concern we have is that, again, for the vast majority of homes in this country, you have a choice only between a telephone company or a cable company for your broadband access. And that necessitates some sort of protection against anti-competitive conduct in the form of discrimination. Have there been a boatload of instances of blocking degradation, so on and so forth? No. There have been a handful over the last 3-4 years. Why is that the case? Well, one of the reasons is that up until very recently, there's been a law prohibiting that. And since that time, the companies have been on their best behavior because there's been this pressure from the online companies and from groups like us to behave well, lest you get legislated.
Well, Gigi, let me get back to the I think the question that you raised was until last summer. I want to address that in a few minutes. But Mike is squirming with regard to.
Well, I'm squirming with the thought that up until recently there was a law prohibiting cable operators from doing what you just said they were doing. There's been no law prohibiting. There's been no network neutrality regulation of cable in the provision of internet service, nor have there been any identifiable problems of the sort that Gigi's mentioning in terms of discrimination.
Well, let's go into detail on this. Last week at the Senate Commerce Committee hearing, there was a panelist that kept reiterating the mantra that or the line that until last summer the internet had been regulated, and I presumably with some type of non-discrimination rules. And I guess let's try to flesh that out, because I think there's a lot of different ways to explain that. Chris, can you explain maybe what that is? That true? Is it not true? Or is it like sort of true?
The answer is that basic duties of non-discrimination have existed in communications law since 1934. There was a Supreme Court decision last year, the Brand X decision, that removed that basic non-discrimination guarantee. That decision took cable services like the ones that Mike was referring to out of any regime that would impose a non-discrimination duty on cable operators. So, you know, he's right in some very narrow sense that there was no FCC rule that said if you are a cable operator, thou shalt not block.
So it's sort of true.
So there's a little ambiguity there, but Gigi's point remains true, is that basic tenet of non-discrimination has been a bipartisan part of telecom policy for the last 70 years. And that's what we're asking to be reinstated. That's what we are asking to be restored in a post-Brand X world.
Can I just clarify one thing? We're not talking about regulating the internet, okay? The applications, services, and content that make up the internet has not been regulated. We're not asking for regulation of that. We're asking for regulation of the on-ramps and off-ramps to the internet.
So the transmission component from the
exactly.
internet to the home.
And it's been that way, as Chris said, for 70 years.
Now, Greg.
Sure. I would argue that Michael is actually right in a very broad sense. Non-discrimination provisions have applied to the provision of telecommunication services, essentially by the monopoly provider, since 1934. And we've always regulated monopolies with non-discrimination provisions, whether there was the only gas line to the home or the only electric line to the home or the only freight train that might have gone to South Dakota to carry a farmer's goods to market. We've always regulated monopolies with non-discrimination provisions. But to say that the internet backbone, those people who provided internet access, have always been operating under non-discrimination provisions just isn't true. The internet backbone is thousands of networks that exchange traffic. And they exchange traffic on a contractual basis, peering agreements, transit agreements. Those are not regulated through non-discriminatory.
Okay, well, let's get to
Cable has, since 1996 when it started building out broadband, never had non-discriminatory obligations placed upon it. And there's never been a problem. The wireless carriers, the wireless cards, the Sprint card, the Verizon wireless card that you see in the marketplace today, those have never had non-discriminatory obligations placed upon them. The Wi-Fi hotspots you go to. And the type of net neutrality we're talking about today would take non-discriminatory obligations straight out of the 1934 Act that regulated monopoly, the telephone monopoly, and it would place it on all of that.
As I mentioned earlier in my opening, that our membership came at this issue from two perspectives. One was that there something happened over the course of the last year that deregulated something that had been regulated before, which infused that kind of transmission layer from the internet to the home with some kind of non-discrimination principle. The other half came at it from the perspective that there are bills in Congress that would bolt on legislation regulation that hadn't been there before. To Greg's point about that fiber maybe had never been under any regulatory regime before this. My question is, what happened last summer? Brand X, what is Brand X? And by the way, for my benefit, if people can explain, like, Title II, if you could explain what that is, because I don't I don't know what you're talking about. So Brand X was a Supreme Court decision last year, and it applied to cable modem service. Yep. And then also there was an FCC DSL order.
Right.
That also happened last year. And then how does that set the stage for where we are today?
So when I was at the agency, we worked on this Brand X decision and litigated it all the way to the Supreme Court. And it has to do with what box you put cable broadband services into, right? In the past, there was some uncertainty about where broadband existed in the statute. In the Supreme Court's decision, it said squarely that when a cable operator provides access to the internet, that's not going to be what's known as a Title II service. A Title II service, you can understand that as being a traditional telecom service that comes with it some level of regulation. The Supreme Court said, you're not in that box, you're in this internet access box, this less regulated box, okay? Now, after that, in August of last year, the commission harmonized the regime that applied to cable operators, and it said to companies like Greg's, you know what, we're going to try to create a level playing field, and we're going to remove something called the Computer 2 rules, which you should understand those to be the basic guarantee of openness on the internet, of non-discrimination. And the commission said, to harmonize the treatment of these two companies, the cable operators and the wannabe cable operators like Verizon, we're going to remove the non-discrimination obligation across the entire network. That is what has led us to today.
Well,
and what we're asking for is the restoration of that basic safeguard so that consumers can go where they want to on the internet and continue to receive things like free phone service.
Well, let me get Michael's comments on that, then we'll go to Greg.
Let me take a step back. It seems like ancient history now because the internet moves so fast, but just maybe 10 years ago or so when we were in a dial-up world, because this is what the proponents of net neutrality say, is that the internet was always subject to, or ISPs were always subject to this kind of common carrier net neutrality regulation. In those days, the role of the telephone company as a common carrier was to dial up to make a call to the ISP. But the ISPs, the people who were the on-ramps to the internet at that point, were not regulated as under net neutrality rules. In a world when this all started, there was AOL and Prodigy. Remember Prodigy? And these were the ways, first of all, they created their own sort of internal dial-up networks that provided services in a sort of walled garden sort of way. If you subscribe to AOL, you got maybe the New York Times through there. The next thing you know, there was the internet, the World Wide Web, and each one of those services figured out that consumers wanted to get the whole range of services out there on the internet. So they began providing service directly to the internet. You could dial up AOL, you could dial up Prodigy, you could dial up Earthlink, and the next thing you know, you get the internet, and no regulation, no requirement that everything be available, that there be no blocking. It evolved that way. The idea that this was a world that was previously regulated, where the on-ramps to the internet were regulated, simply is not true.
But here's the difference. Okay, the difference is in the ISPs. What was this, 10 years ago? There were hundreds of them. Okay, thousands of them. Now there's only a handful. I mean, there was competition. And that's the other point. Non-discrimination point is the one thing to keep in mind. The other thing to keep in mind is the utter lack of competition in the broadband field. And do not have anybody tell you, well, satellite's a competitor. They barely get up to broadband speeds. And I would recommend to staffers that they read the GAO broadband report. To the extent that there's broadband over power lines in 1% of the country. Now, you can say all you want there is competition in the last mile broadband service, but it's just not true. And the FCC and the GAO have found it. I've not seen any reliable source that shows otherwise.
Greg?
Yeah, I think this debate in some ways have kind of an Alice in Wonderland feel to it. When you look at what's actually going in the marketplace, which kind of gets to Tim's original question, what is the problem? There have been four hearings so far in the Senate and the House. All the advocates for net neutrality, who interestingly have bigger market caps than the Bells and the cable companies combined.
I don't.
Except for Gigi. Fair point.
Yet.
But the other folks. Yet.
Never.
They had plenty of opportunity to come and talk about what the problem is. I mean, normally when we regulate, whether it's clean air or clean water or highway safety, and I was up here for 9 years on the Commerce Committee in the House and the Senate, we had lots of hearings about regulation. And normally the prerequisite for regulating, for getting out there and actually enacting new regulation, which is what the net neutrality folks are seeking, is a problem, is some kind of evidence of a problem. Dirty air, dirty water, accidents on the highways. So you talk about what the problem is, you identify it, and you try to solve it with regulation that actually is aimed at that problem. Now, that's been completely absent from this debate. Now, whether you want to call the market competitive or not competitive, or duopoly or a competitive market, or whether you want to include the Sprint and the Verizon wireless cards as competition or not, the actual facts are that since these decisions have taken place, since cable was deregulated in 1996, cable broadband modem penetration has exploded. Prices have come down, and speeds have gone up. Since Verizon was deregulated in that 2003 decision, which Gigi vilifies, well, we finally started putting fiber into the ground. And now we are offering consumers broadband access of 5 megabits, 15 megabits, and 30 megabits downstream. We never did that previously.
Had you had fiber, whether or not you would under a regulatory...
Had you
started laying fiber before that decision, would that fiber be regulated under those rules?
I'm not aware, but I will tell you that, well, the rules would have changed. Rules would have deregulated fiber
bills. But would they have been regulated before that?
Well, I guess the point is
had you dropped in fiber on the ground?
Up until then, we competed with cable with a copper technology called DSL, which puts electronics at both ends, and in the central office and in the home, and that's how we competed with cable modem service. Since that decision, when those monopoly regulations from 1934 were lifted, because the FCC said we are witnessing so much more competition in the marketplace, our prices have gone down and our speeds have gone up. And by the way, the Pew Group, which we have not any affiliation with that I'm aware of, just came out with a report. They said that broadband penetration is up 40% since that 2003 decision. So you can call this market, you know...
Market power, and actually all riddled all throughout the different one pages that you'll read, which you'll probably all read tonight, there is a lot of discussion about market power. Market power keeps popping up, and as I mentioned, the Sensenbrenner-Conyers Boucher bill addresses the net neutrality issue within the Judiciary Committee by taking the Clayton Act, which is an antitrust part of the law that says thou shalt not be anti-competitive, and it says if you have market power, then you cannot do anything to harm. Market power, as I understand it, is defined by, in short, it's huge, long case law and big, long analysis. And I'm going to really simplify it here by saying what the Supreme Court said was the ability for a firm to raise prices. And if there is competition, they just don't have that power to raise prices. And I've just, as a DSL customer, my prices for DSL have been going down. So how does the market, you say there's a duopoly. You said, I think you mentioned that the FCC report said that 97% of, but if my prices are going down, I'm assuming that they can't raise those prices and it's a competitive marketplace. So how does Conyers, Sensenbrenner work in that regard when prices are indeed going down?
But if you start to charge the providers for some sort of, you know, high-speed tier access, who are they going to pass the costs on to?
Okay.
I mean, that's what's going to happen.
So it's not consumer
costs.
So it's not consumer costs.
I don't know why it has to be limited to the consumer costs, but ultimately it will pass on to the consumers.
The answer is that prices generally don't go down unless you're facing competition. That's what forces you to lower prices. Companies don't take out full-page ads in the Washington Post to get subscribers if they have enormous market power. They get that because they need to lower prices in order to get those subscribers because they're facing competition.
Tim. I mean, you know, let's not talk about Washington. Let's not talk about San Francisco.
Fair enough.
Let's
Fair
talk
enough.
About Omaha, Nebraska.
We had Cox You have a good story there.
No, well, but
have we been hearing reports that in Omaha that prices have gone to the cable or DSL price? Have we heard reports of that?
Well, let's take a step back.
You just wanted to go back, don't you? I thought you were moving forward.
Yeah, when we say, when you say prices go up or prices go down, really, that's a simplified way of talking about the market power,
you know,
market where people are selling widgets that don't change over time. Really what you're talking about is there a competitive response? Sometimes prices go down as a result of competition. Sometimes competition takes the form of service competition, of constantly trying to capture market share by enhancing the product. In fact, in a market like we've got now, enhancing the product of an evolution of an evolving product like the internet is something that is capturing market share. It is the better way to, it is probably the better way to compete. But if you think that because there are two providers in a community, some my members and some Greg's company, that we're just sitting back and dividing the market up between ourselves and not competing, you're not paying attention to what's going on out there. This is cutthroat competition because we're evolving, trying to provide, each company trying to provide what's now being referred to as the triple play or the quadruple play of internet, voice, video, and data, and trying and market share for a capital-intensive business like ours is very important. So we're trying to capture additional subscribers.
Let me just say, does Verizon, does Comcast, cable companies, do they, AT&T, do they have market power?
Yes, and Gigi is right, and Gigi pointed you as staff to the right numbers to look to. Yes, there's a duopoly in place in the broadband market. And as much as we'd like to pretend that there is this coming competitive landscape, it's just not here yet. The best evidence of this market power is what the CEOs of the major telcos have told you. And to their credit, they have announced their plans. And they have told each and every one of you, right, operators, right? This is not a world that the internet has known to date. This is a radical change in the business models that have led to an open internet. And what they've said is, we need to burn the internet to save it. We need to impose these charges on websites so we can deploy broadband. And I guess I would ask for some critical thinking on this point. I spent 3 years at the FCC, and contrary to what Greg was suggesting, there was a stream of arguments that if they got this regulatory relief, if they got this regulatory relief, if they got that regulatory relief, they would deploy. This is just another example of them holding hostage the notion of broadband deployment to regulatory relief. All we're really asking for is a minimal safeguard to protect users who want to go where they want to on the internet.
Michael?
That minimal safeguard, which took the form of Title II common carrier regulation for years in the telephone world, was not exactly minimal.
And that's not what we're arguing
for
here.
For
we're arguing for the following language, that a network operator shall not discriminate on the basis of ownership or source on the internet. It's
Greg,
as simple as that.
Greg?
When we're talking about discrimination here, that's not a new word in telecom. I mean, first of all, let's be clear.
Thanks for admitting that.
It's not. Well, what I mean by that is, first of all, it's not the insidious discrimination when we talk about discrimination. It's not. We're not talking about race or religion or creed or color or anything like that. That's all covered by the civil rights laws. Discrimination is about. It is embedded in Section 202A of the Communications Act, and all I mean by that is, in 1934, when Congress started regulating communications or telephone communications, it saw a monopoly. The only way you could get from point A to point B over a wire was over the telephone wire. So they imposed non-discriminatory obligations on the telephone wire. That is the core, and that word is 70 years of precedent going back to then. That is the core of what the net neutrality folks want to now place on all broadband providers.
Gigi?
All of them. And that is what's the, now if you want minimal regulation, there are minimal regulations out there, and we can have an honest discussion about how to protect consumers to make sure that you get to every website or that you can run any application or that you can attach any device.
Actually, the term non-discriminatory or non-discrimination appears in the Communications Act 72 times. So 71 times more than Greg. So it doesn't have one meaning, okay? Although it isn't, I'm happy to hear Greg admit that it isn't a complicated concept because some of his bosses have told me otherwise. Let me tell you about a regulation that prohibits non-discrimination that Verizon really likes to use. It's called the Program Access Rules. It's Section 628 of the Communications Act, and it prohibits cable operators from discriminating in price terms and conditions in making available the programming they own. So they have to make it available to satellite providers, to folks like Verizon, who now have the new Fios cable system. They have to provide on non-discriminatory price terms and conditions. The regulations for program access, once you get past the definitions, are about 4 pages long in the Code of Federal Regulation. And Verizon now has filed 2 program access complaints, one against Comcast and one against Rainbow Media Holdings, because they think that non-discrimination is perfectly fine in the provision of cable programming. So I find it kind of curious that in some situations, non-discrimination is fine, but in other situations, it's not fine.
Well, one other thing.
The program access rules have been around for 15 years. There've only been several dozen complaints filed. It's a complaint process, much like the one we want here, and it's largely been self-effectuating. So, notion is to be heavy-duty regulation with, you know, huge government oversight is just not the case.
Well, you know, let me ask you.
Let me try to.
Sure, sure.
I don't want you to be curious. I've known you for a long time. The program access rule is actually a great way for. I would love Congress to approach this debate the way Congress approached the program access rules in the early 90s. I mean, back then you had satellite companies who were trying to get into the cable business and compete. And a lot of the cable networks were owned by those cable companies. And there were hearings, and there was evidence of a problem. And once they saw the problem, Congress grafted a very narrowly tailored solution to a specific problem that had been identified. And if you look at it, and it's Section 628 of the Cable Act, if you look at that, it is riddled with exceptions for legitimate business practices. Now, again, I would be very happy to see Congress engage in that kind of critical analysis on net neutrality. And if Congress identifies a problem along the lines of what anyone is discussing, then let's talk about how to solve that problem.
Well, why doesn't the FCC have... the FCC apparently has some kind of ancillary authority, as exhibited in the Madison River case of last year. Chairman Majoris of the Federal Trade Commission has said that they have the ability to step in if their consumers are harmed. Why does Congress have to do anything? Isn't there existing legal authority at the moment, as exhibited in Madison River? And I know Gigi was right. I mean, that's an easy question. It was a matter of just simple blocking of ports of a VoIP provider. But in discrimination, as Gigi has described it, doesn't the FCC have the existing legal authority? Doesn't the FTC can step in?
Yeah. The answer to the FCC question is no. The Commission does not have the existing legal authority to impose a non-discrimination obligations on network owners. The Madison River case, that was a settlement. There was nothing legal about that case. That case was the FCC saying, hey, we see a problem, we're going to investigate this, and it's settled.
And the Barton bill actually says that the FCC has a case-by-case authority to address these issues. So would that be a step up from the existing authority?
Case-by-case adjudication is important, and it's something that can be used to protect openness on the Internet. But what you need, and this is something that only Congress can do, is a rule of decision. That's why when you hear Gigi and I talk about non-discrimination, that is the rule of decision that we're asking the agency to enforce case by case. It is possible to come up with a regime that is very lightweight, that it deals only with discriminatory behavior and enforces that right case by case at the agency.
And Mike?
Well, it sounds like so far you don't need case by case authority, you just need case authority, because there's only one case that's come up in this whole discussion over all the years.
I don't know what more threat do you need to an open internet than the exercise of market power by telcos arguing for discriminatory charges on Google, Yahoo, eBay, and Microsoft?
Well, actually, argument.
What other evidence do you need?
Argument.
What would be best for
argument?
Yes,
argument is rarely sufficient evidence to impose a layer of regulation, prophylactic regulation, in an area where you can always. This is not a case. I mean, we heard lots of arguments back in the time of the open access debate that, you know, if you don't impose a rule now that forces access by all kinds of unaffiliated ISPs to the network, the networks might get built in a way that forecloses that. So we better do this regulation now or we'll never be able to unscramble the eggs. This is not a case like that. This is a case that says if there's discrimination, there should be a rule against discrimination, and if there's a problem, there's time. We're not opposed to the kind of vigilant restraint that the FCC has from the outset thought was the appropriate approach, which is not to say, walk away from this, let's not worry about it, the marketplace will work. It's to say, keep an eye on this. People have identified potential anti-competitive things that people can do, and if the marketplace evolves in a way that these sorts of things begin to happen, then let's see if there's a regulation that's appropriate. But if you put a regulation on in advance, people people's behavior is inhibited by the possibility.
Michael, I think Greg wants to help you out here.
I wanted to pick up on something that Michael said about the open access debate. For those of you, and I see a lot of familiar faces in the room, who have been following telecommunications policy for a while now, this is really the continuation of a debate that's been going on for many, many years. In 1996, during the Telecom Act, there were a lot of folks who wanted to place much stronger economic regulation on information services. Because if we didn't do that, the marketplace would shut down and you'd have these dominant providers. And, you know, the Democrats and the Republicans, frankly, said no at that time. And then in 1999, what Michael just referred to, the Internet access providers, cable at that time was the major broadband Internet access provider, not the telcos. And AOL said, we have to have access to that network. And if you don't allow us, guarantee us, legislate access to that network, competition will shut down, deployment penetration will go down.
Well,
and the Cunard FCC.
Greg, I think different here today.
Well, we're not talking about something very different. We're talking about networks, the investment made in networks, and we have folks who really want access to that networks, and they want government to regulate the terms and conditions of those access.
Absolutely not. This is about consumer access to the network. It's not about our access to the network.
The bill introduced about the service provider's access and rights to access and services on the network. The legislation.
So this is an important point. If we could explore this just a little. I mean, what you're going to start hearing over the next few days is that there's this wholesale thing and there's this consumer thing, and that maybe net neutrality is appropriate as a solution to the consumer problem, but don't worry about the providers on the net, the wholesale providers like Google, Yahoo, and Microsoft. And it's just too simple. All of the costs of these networks are ultimately borne by the consumers. Consumers pay all these costs. No matter if Greg's company imposes a charge on Google or Yahoo, those costs will all get passed to the end user. And what we're saying is the best way to build differentiated products and faster speed networks is allow consumers to choose whether they want more bandwidth or less.
So by costs all being, put on the consumers, are you saying that, as I've heard before, that Google and Skype and others are getting a free lunch?
No, because, look...
Does Google pay for the network on the net,
right?
And why do they pay on the net?
Pay because they offer big... They provide big server farms that need to get their traffic onto the Internet. And they pay companies that are network owners lots of millions of dollars a year to get their traffic on the net. And the beauty of the Internet is that consumers pay to pull that down. You don't pay to land your traffic. Consumers pay to pull it down from the net. We're trying to preserve that system, that of transparent bandwidth markets. And in fact, in another context, the telcos have been very, very progressive in their advocacy about pushing charges to the edge in the circuit switch world. And what we're saying is don't recreate that bad regulation in the Internet. Leave consumers in control of what bandwidth they subscribe to.
Greg and then Mike.
Sure, consumers have control today, and I guess a lot's been talking about the future, what Verizon's plans are for the future. So let me tell you what I know about our plans for the future. We are deploying fiber. We are for the first time actually doing fiber straight to the home, which will allow us to do a lot of things. And frankly, will allow us to do for consumers at the home what we've been able to do for businesses for a long time, which is much more bandwidth and a lot of other features like security and reliability and enhanced connectivity and things like that. Those are things that consumers want. We want to do that. So we're always going to give consumers a choice between levels of Internet access. That's not going to stop. In addition to the 5 megabits or the 15 megabits or the 30 megabits, we want to be able to provide service providers, like content providers, with enhanced security. Or we want to provide healthcare providers with enhanced connectivity or security, or financial institutions, or whatever it is, on top of the Internet access that we provide to consumers. Okay. And that market hasn't even gelled yet. But we're saying is let us develop that market. Let us reach those commercial
markets. I think, Greg, you're talking about your three-laser thing, right? And I don't mean to be flip. You have three lasers, which are fiber to the home, when it comes to your advanced services. So you have one laser for video, right? And you're going to IPTV, presumably, we'll go over that. One laser for access to the kind of public.
We have a beam of light that essentially goes through the fiber and pulses literally billions of times a second. That carries the video stream or carries the Internet access, another one for the Internet access stream, another one for other streams. And we want to be able to really develop products and services with that capacity.
But as Tom Talkie said in detail, and then I've heard Mike McKeon and Link say in detail, you have three different lasers, and each has almost unlimited capacity to a certain extent. One for video for your IPTV service, one for access to the Internet, and then one for VPNs. And VPNs, I guess, are virtual private networks, and they're like sheaths of encryption or tunnels, essentially, to specific services, perhaps telemedicine, other applications. Why couldn't, if you could narrowly craft a bill to impose network neutrality or non-discrimination provisions on, like, the middle laser that goes to kind of the general internet and leave yourself to experiment with the other two lasers, why wouldn't that be acceptable?
First of all, there's no bill I've seen that does that.
Okay, but if there were a bill.
And second of all, I would ask you, we are in the process right now, and the entire marketplace is in the process of increasing speeds to the home and decreasing prices. And it's this regulatory regime that some folks don't like today that has led to this. So I don't want to predict what the regulatory consequences would be, but I would say this to you. No broadband network has ever been constructed, other than our copper DSL network, which I wouldn't consider an advanced network. No broadband network has ever been constructed, wireline or wireless or satellite, under the regulatory regime of non-discrimination. So
let me ask Gigi a question.
Yeah.
With regard to investment in Wall Street, going back, I guess we want to go back several years now, to the fiber, laying of fiber all across the continent and across the world market of several years ago. You all remember Global Crossing, all the other, you know, even Teledesic, which was a Craig McCaw satellite thing. Lots of investment were poured into laying fiber all over the place. And essentially that created kind of a Wall Street investment bubble. And when it realized that the demand just wasn't there for that capacity, the whole market tanked and everybody went bankrupt and it was a disaster. It also was a bit of a WorldCom issue, as you may recall. And I guess there's something to be said for Greg's point is that don't they need to have some insurances on investment of building out the new fiber to the home? And won't Wall Street, if there are neutrality provisions imposed upon that, won't Wall Street again spank these companies and the investment will go out of it?
Well, first of all, the investment is happening, and it's happening now. It's been happening for years. But we are not saying you can't provide security services. We're not saying you can't provide virtual private networks. We're not saying you can't provide these value-added services. What we're saying is you can't discriminate. And you can't charge extra as a condition of carriage. So, yeah, we are saying there is a very, very narrow business model in which you cannot engage, and that's a discriminatory business model. But beyond that, go and God bless. Make all the money you want.
Mike?
Well, this is if we're talking about a much narrower net neutrality than some of the bills that we've looked at and some of the policies that are out there, if you two guys are talking about a much narrower one, then I have a question, which is that access to the internet, I mean, most people get to the site that they're going to on the web through Internet Explorer or through Google or through one of the search engines. At least as many people use those that small handful of portals to the internet as use the variant. There are more than one cable operator in the country, by the way, and more than one telephone company as an ISP that might have affiliated interests. Would you not have the same concern that the Googles and the Internet Explorers of the world would also have an incentive to favor and discriminate against getting you to the...
I get to go robust, after Gigi, though.
There's robust competition in search engines. Just because people like Google and Yahoo a lot and favor them doesn't mean there's competition.
Here's my point about...
There's Firefox. I mean, you can keep going. But here's another point. And Harold Feld from Media Access Project made this excellent point at a Senate Commerce Committee briefing the other day, is that the switching cost, what does it cost me to switch from Google to Firefox? Zilcho.
Well, let me ask you.
What would it cost me to switch from my bundled cable operator, which I have now, to DSL? A lot.
Let me play devil's advocate on behalf of Michael. Yeah, it does seem that there's a lot of competition in the search engine marketplace. I'll grant you. But when it comes to computer chips, there isn't as much competition in computer chips, let's say. There's really only two manufacturers of computer chips in the world, really. And we a couple months ago, we had the CEO of AMD here at Internet Caucus Speaker Series, and they're the other chip manufacturer, and they found that when Skype had rolled out its service, it had developed a certain teleconferencing service of 10 or more people could teleconference over the internet, but you could only do it if you were running this particular high-end Intel super fast chip. If you were running anything lower, you couldn't. If you were in an AMD chip, you couldn't run it. And in your one-pager, Chris, you had said that part of the freedoms or the non-discrimination we're talking about is the ability to connect any device to the internet and have it worked. How does your, a consumer's ability not to have this super-fast internet work, how do you square that?
So this is what I learned in my 3 years as a regulator is you know you're on to something when they start changing the subject, right? The subject is, in net neutrality, the market power of network operators.
But
now
here,
let's go to the applications layer. There are certain chips that can't handle 10-person video conferencing well, okay? And we, as a company, wanted to increase the, we wanted to improve the consumer experience. There was nothing exclusive about
it. But they're saying the same thing.
Who's saying the same thing?
The Verizons, the Comcast, they want to improve the consumer experience.
But the point is that what you have in the network operator space is two companies that are providing network access to upwards of 95% of the country. And what we're saying is that exercise of market power looks causes concern for openness and innovation on the internet. The fact is, and he'll now draw an analogy between the Intel-AMD duopoly and the network operator duopoly. There are other chipsets out there, and that software that you referred to can work on AMD. So there is openness at the application layer. There is choice at the application layer. Folks can choose to not use Skype if they don't want to make free phone calls and they want to pay. Yahoo Messenger.
Greg?
Yeah, I want to get back. I don't want to change the subject, so I want to get back to where we were on search engines. You know, Verizon has a search engine. I'm sure most of you don't use it because it's nowhere near as good as Google. In fact, I frankly don't use it. I use Google. But it's called Superpages. And every day, people over Verizon DSL go to Google and not Superpages. So it gets back to Gigi's point about discrimination. We have every reason in this world where we're the evil network operator in a duopoly to discriminate against Google and drive traffic to Superpages. We compete against Vonage every day. Vonage has several hundred thousand customers on telephone lines, and there's never been a problem with any of the large telephone companies discriminating against Vonage. Other than Madison River, I don't have any problem with any telephone company. Time Warner, one of Michael's companies, has lots of content online. They provide broadband internet access. Time Warner's never been accused of discriminating in favor of their own content, and despite that, not one day of Time Warner's existence has a non-discrimination obligation been upon it.
Can I ask Greg a question about that? Help us, the audience, and me understand what you mean when you say you don't discriminate against VoIP applications in the wireless space. When I bought EVDO service, I bought this card and I got to use it as broadband access to the internet, but when I signed up, the terms of service said I can't use it for VoIP. What's not discriminatory about that?
I think there was someone on the wireless company who wanted to be on the panel to answer. That's a technical question. So I apologize. And if there's someone in the audience who could answer it, that might be a good thing.
Right.
You asked the question.
Okay.
Let me do my best. When I've heard the wireless companies talk about this, they are very spectrum constrained. They don't have fiber. They buy channels. They buy megahertz channels. And they really can't expand much of what they have other than compression technology, which they are advancing. And maybe one day you will be able to run VoIP. But I think the management challenges that a wireless operator has are much greater than the management challenges that a cable or a Verizon operator
has. And we would actually agree with you on that. There are unique challenges in the wireless space, but our ask is that if you're going to have network management policies in place, that they be non-discriminatory. So you don't just shut out Skype and allow the VoIP client.
Greg just made the case for why wireless is not a third line competitor, is not a broadband competitor. You just described why. Your EVDO contract says no peer-to-peer,
I think this is one important point I just want to make. Verizon Wireless's broadband card does not allow Verizon's VoiceWing VoIP service either. We are not discriminating in favor of a Verizon product against Vonage or against Skype. There is a blanket non-discriminatory rule against VoIP providers.
Well, let me give another wireless scenario, and then I'll ask. I've used up a lot of my time, I apologize, and we'll go to cash questions. But Craig McCaw, who built AT&T Wireless, McCaw Wireless before it, is now rolling out a service he's calling ClearWire. And very clearly, in ClearWire's terms of use statement, it says you cannot use a VoIP service over, it's a WiMAX service, wireless WiMAX service. You can't use your own VoIP service over it, but rather we'll use our own VoIP service. I think that's what they're saying. And the question is, now, ClearWire is not a Bell. It's not a cable company. It if any of these network or pick one that goes into implementation, whether it be Markey, whether it be Sensenbrenner, whether it be Stevens, whether it be Wyden Snow or Snow Dorgan, forgive me, would that those net neutrality rules prevent McCaw from Craig McCaw and Clearwire from prioritizing their own VIP service over their own wireless service? And if so,
absolutely.
Okay. And if so, doesn't that kind of thwart what we're trying to get at with more competition, more providers? It's an open question.
But the point is that if they're going to be out there providing a service and they're going to call it Internet Access Service, it has to do that. It has to provide access to the Internet.
I don't think he's calling that. I think he's saying, I'm going to build a wireless service.
Are you saying, I'm going to build a wireless service, and by the way, you can't use Skype on this. You can't go to that particular part of the Internet.
Isn't that a marketplace decision to use his service or not?
It is at some level, but we scratch our heads when we get the idea that when there are multiple facilities-based competitors, you'd expect more openness. But when you look at the wireless market, where you do have three or four facilities-based competitors, you see some of the most closed networks ever. You see network operators acting as if the handset is their own private desktop and only allowing affiliated services on that desktop. And that seems odd to us, and it seems to violate net neutrality norms.
Craig?
Yeah, I think you've hit on the nut of the argument. Another policy goal, I would argue, would be the central policy goal of Congress, should be to get more and more broadband networks out there. If the problem is there's not enough competition among broadband networks, I would argue there's a lot of competition, but you can always have more. So if the goal of policy should be to get more broadband networks out there, then just look at the history of telecom regulation. You've never incented, whether you're Democrat or Republican, the Congress or the FCC has never successfully gotten more investment by placing greater regulation. That's just in the cable world, in the telco world, in the wireless world, in the satellite world. That has never happened. So this is an enormous leap of faith that we're going to take all this new regulation, we're going to take stuff straight out of the 1934 Act, we're going to put it on every broadband provider invented today, invented tomorrow, the folks who buy at the 700 megahertz auction, the folks who buy at the AWS auction. We're going to tell all of them that you're going to live with these rules that have been in place for decades. That's not, I would argue, that's just not a good way to get broadband investment into the marketplace.
Tim, if I could just address that for a second. I think, we're kind of changing the subject, and it's a very important subject. I think none of us would be here if there were four or five competitors in most markets. Okay, that's not the case. It's not going to be the case for the distant future. Greg talked about the AWS auction. One great way to get another competitor out there is if your company and his companies would be prohibited from bidding. We don't even know if that spectrum may go to one of you guys. And then what kind of competition do we have? So I think that's at least one way ensuring that the dominant providers can't get access to the means for creating competition might be a great policy to jumpstart competition, but it doesn't get away from the fact that right now and for the foreseeable future and maybe those decades you talk about, we're only going to have two dominant providers.
And I think Greg's comment really touches on the politics and the policy that's at play in the net neutrality debate. You know, what he describes is a world where you have to incent broadband providers to build deeper fiber networks, more capable fiber networks. And what you're hearing the edge community, the internet community say is that that's only half of the equation. And if you only focus your policy on the incentives of network operators, you have forgotten about our own investment incentives, because what we need is a stable playing field so that we can develop the next generation of applications.
Okay.
Nobody wants just to buy Verizon for open bandwidth. They want to buy it to do stuff with that bandwidth. And we provide one of those things.
Well, as I promised earlier, I took up way too much time with my own questions. But to be sure, these are questions that people have sent me. So these were not my own questions. I'd like to ask any of you if you have any questions. And again, I'll repeat them for the microphone so we can hear. Dan Horowitz has been chomping at the bit. Point of order, Dan, when I said that the first broadband hearing was done by the Internet Caucus 10 years ago, I wasn't around. I was somewhere, but I wasn't here. Dan Horowitz was with Congressman Rick White's office, who was a founder of the Internet Caucus, and he was planning many of those events. So he really had a lot more vision than I did. So, Dan, your question.
One of these years, Tim's going to stop saying that. You realize how long it worked. Quick question for you. Looking at the advertising that's come on the past week or two, looking at the lobbying speeches, isn't NCPA starting to use net neutrality as an issue, as a stalking horse to kill a telecom bill because they actually really hate only other significant provisions
let you.
That's an easy one for you, Mike.
Can you just repeat? I can't repeat that. Can you repeat that?
And Mike says he wants all the press to quote him on this.
And I don't know. I mean, the ads that you've been reading, the ads you've been seeing on net neutrality are not all our ads. It's a stalking horse. We've been out on the hustings.
Mike, if you could repeat the question, though. Really.
I think the question is, aren't we just opposed using net neutrality as a stalking horse because we don't like the franchising bills that are moving through the Congress? I'm here to talk about net neutrality because I've been talking about net neutrality for longer than there's been a franchising bill. That net neutrality has been an issue, and from where we sit in the industry, it's funny. I mean, yeah, there are two sides, and the one side we hear is the anti-competitive potential. But when I talk to our guys in the industry, the reason they shake about this stuff is not just because the people who want to make commercial deals and want to make sure that there's resources and that Wall Street responds to investment incentives, but also because our networks have been evolving every step of the way. If I were to ask you or you were to ask me what services are going to be out there a year from now, what's the network going to look like, neither one of us is going to know. So, for example, the movement to peer-to-peer made a huge difference in the way the Internet developed after we began developing our systems. And as we need more bandwidth, there are more bandwidth-intensive uses, our guys keep trying to think of ways to ensure that the quality of the experience for the people who continue to some people are going to only want to get the New York Times on the web, some people want to get video streaming, and we want to make sure that the quality of the experience is suitable so that we keep getting those customers and maintain the quality of service for all those customers, and different business models keep evolving for that. So that's what our concerns have been, and yeah, we don't like the franchising bill a bit, and I could talk about that all day too, but that's
please don't.
But that's not what this issue is about.
Any other questions? In the back, and then here, and then there.
A lot of information out there on net neutrality. Bottom line is, we have to go back and brief our congressmen or our senators on which way to vote. And I don't think there's a clear answer for that. If you hadn't briefed a member of Congress or senator on why you should vote for or against the marketing ban on net neutrality, what would you tell them to make them understand clearly what they're voting on? And how we should vote.
Wow. Okay. The question is
question.
25 words.
Yeah. To brief a member, a congressman, or a senator on which way to vote on a net neutrality bill, and I guess specifically on the Markey bill. How would you get the member to understand it? And I was hoping that this panel would do that. In which way would you vote? In 25 words or less, I guess.
I would say vote yes on the Markey bill because, unlike the net neutrality provisions in the bigger COPE Act, it has a non-discrimination prohibition.
And how would you get him to understand? How would you get him to understand the issue?
Do you like your cable service? Do you like the fact that you can't pick and choose what channels you want on your cable system? Would you like the Internet to look like a cable system? If you don't, then vote for the Markey Amendment.
Gigi's, that's exactly right.
Don't steal it. Okay, let me go to Greg and...
Okay. We'll get back to the cableizing the Internet rhetoric in a minute.
It works.
It does work, but we'll get back there in a minute. I'm happy to go with you, by the way, if you want to have a longer discussion. I think what I'd say is that we're in a great place right now. We're in a regulatory sweet spot, so to speak. And this kind of gets to what Chris said before. We have tons of regulation going on within the network. You've got fiber being built in the wireline network. You've got all kinds of wireless providers and satellite providers putting tons of money into developing the next broadband internet service. And you've got tons of innovation going on at the edge of the network. The Googles and the Yahoos and the small indie films companies or whatever it is, the enhanced VoIP providers, the streaming video folks, are putting tons of money in innovation, which is, I mean, it's a symbiotic relationship. We can't live without each other. And it's all working right now. So until there's a problem, don't risk what essentially is a good thing that's working with unnecessary regulation. And if the proponents who are coming to you, Mr. Congressman, with nothing more than a Business Week article quoting the head of AT&T are saying this is what you should base all this regulation on, it's not worth taking the risk. I would vote
okay.
No.
25. Mike?
Well, I can't stand that I got to agree with the telephone companies. But that's the argument. we've been out there that I would say, as I said before, be vigilant. Watch to see if all these anti-competitive things happen, but be understanding, as members would be, having seen efforts at regulation before and the cost of regulation and the cost of imposing regulation on new technologies, be careful that you don't thwart the development that consumers would want. As long as the marketplace is going forward and more people are responding more favorably to each new step as internet services get deployed and high-speed internet services get enhanced, it shows that consumers are responding favorably and there is no identifiable problem. When there is an identifiable problem, come back and see if there's a tailored way to fix it.
So that's no on Markey, right? Okay.
Wait, don't I get to brief the congressman?
I thought you were going to... Okay, yes, you get...
No, I would say, congressman, do you think the internet's a good thing? Do you think that the fact that people on eBay can make their primary employment on eBay is a good thing? Do you think that Google and all the innovation that's happened at the edge of the network is a good thing? Do you want to reelect the internet in some sense? If you do, you'd vote for the Markey Amendment. If you're for discrimination, then you vote against the Markey Amendment.
That was a fun exercise. Right here, question?
Yeah, hi. Obviously, the House Commerce and Energy Committee felt fairly strongly in a bipartisan sense not to include network neutrality language in their bill. And obviously, the Rules Committee, yes, they decided differently after some, prodding from the Sensenbrenner bill. What do you take from that, that ultimately tomorrow it seems the House will be all the Walmarts will have a chance to vote yay or nay on that. And what do you think that means? It seemed a couple of weeks ago this whole matter was dead. What does thing you take from that? Does this have some momentum that maybe wasn't there 2 weeks ago?
I'll allow a clarification of the question.
Clarification. Dan? Point of order for House rules is quite simple. I'm sorry, I work for a small business committee now, but some people have implied I work for a couple other offices. The Rules Committee does not decide between chairmen. They don't make decisions whether they're going to refer Mr. Barton's bill. Mr. Dreyer doesn't sit there and be the kingmaker between different chairmen's provisions. There's an argument to be made on the jurisdiction, on the facts, and whether the issue should be aired. They don't choose between chairmen.
Okay, let me try to rephrase the question. The question is, at a certain point, asking the analyst to comment on, at a certain point, the House Commerce Committee did not include certain net neutrality provisions in its bill, but presumably there's been a change for perhaps a variety of different ways by the Rules Committee to actually bring the net neutrality provisions to a vote on the floor. Perhaps that was prodded by some other committee's action, perhaps not. But regardless, do you make anything out of this change in events that we've seen over the past couple weeks?
I think members have been hearing from their constituents. I mean, the SaveTheInternet.com coalition has 750,000 members, and I'm sure there are, many tens of thousands more that are very, very concerned. I think had they not allowed any vote on a net neutrality provision, they just would have been unleashing. So some of us maybe would almost have preferred that, right? Because to not have that process would really have unleashed a tidal wave. Would it have been better to have a bipartisan amendment up for vote? Obviously, you'd prefer to have that, particularly in a Congress that is, controlled by Republicans, and there are no Republicans on this amendment. But, I think there was a concerted decision saying, look, if we deny a vote on this at all, then we're really going to hear it from our constituents. We've been hearing it from them already, so we just absolutely can't say no net neutrality vote at all.
Yeah, I just wanted to make one point on that. There is actually a net neutrality provision in the Barton bill. If you're worried about the cablizing the internet, as Gigi says, that you actually won't be able to get to choose where you want to go on the internet, that providers are going to make it that decision for you, there is a provision in the bill. It says that consumers can go anywhere they want, they can attach any device, they can run any application. That is in the Barton bill. And if a network operator goes bad on that, it's hit with $500,000 fine. So if your concern is let's protect consumers from the thing. I don't imagine we would do any of those things because Michael's companies are praying that we do because the consumer would actually just run over to Michael's company and buy the service there. But if your bosses are concerned that we will do those things, you don't need to support market. You can support what's in the Barton bill right now.
But the problem where the Barton bill falls short is that there's no non-discrimination principle. So I, as a consumer, can go to my Vonage service, but if it's being degraded by a telco or cable system, I've satisfied, right? They've satisfied the COPE Act, but they've not satisfied a non-discrimination principle. So that's where it falls short.
So you can have both. You can have broadband deployment and you can have net neutrality. You can have, instead of six companies, you can have 6,006 companies in this ecosystem. And that balanced approach to net neutrality is the one that we've urged, and that's why we think the Markey Amendment's the right way to go.
Okay, well, I'll go to the next person over there. That is a comment, not a question. Is that a comment? Not?
I don't know anything about that particular situation, and I'm happy to learn about it and respond to folks who want to know more about it. I will say that what's in the Markey Amendment goes, I would say, light years beyond the problem that's been raised. If there's an issue about networks connecting with other networks, that's an issue you can address, and that can be dealt with. And if there is a real problem there, there could be hearings, something could be dealt with. The Markey Amendment, it goes way beyond the problem that was just raised, and I don't even know actually if it would solve it.
Okay,
I don't even think the market maybe even addresses that issue.
There's a question right over here. Well, just let me repeat the question for the microphone. The question was that maybe Congress is a little too hot right now to kind of deal with this issue. The COPE Act prohibits the Federal Communications Commission from making a rulemaking, and perhaps a more democratic thing to do would be allow the independent agency, the Federal Communications Commission, rather than the United States Congress. Forgive me for making the point that Congress is democratic. That's the kind of the point.
Yes,
very loud. I'm not trying to give a civil lecture, but the idea is that wouldn't it be easy for cooler heads to prevail, just let the FCC do a rulemaking in a more democratic...
Right. I think there are two responses to your completely valid concern and question. The first is that the reason why you're hearing volume on our side is that this issue is about our fundamental right to continue to innovate. You have to take as axiomatic the notion that more bandwidth allows us to innovate more, okay? The second answer is the Commission lacks authority to do what you want it to do. The Commission needs authority from Congress to legislate in this area.
But you still have to give them the authority to do it. That's the problem.
So you would rewrite COPE.
So you amend COPE in the Senate.
Amend COPE in the Senate.
Wow.
Allow the FCC to regulate.
But
Under what rule of decision, though? Just give them carte blanche to figure out what the right answer is.
I don't know that he would.
I don't think any of us. I don't know.
I don't think I would be able to answer that either. Yeah.
I think you make a very good point, which is this issue has kind of sprung upon Congress, and it's a very serious question, which is we want a lot more broadband. We want a lot of innovation in the network. We want a lot of innovation at the edge of the network. We want consumers to benefit from all of that. That's a very important question. It goes to communications. It goes to speech. It goes to economic development. It goes to our international competitiveness. There's a lot at stake here, and it has been sprung upon very quickly. So this, the right thing to do, I would argue, be get it right in Congress. Take some time. Examine the issue. Try to identify what the problems are. Are there any problems? If there are problems, how do you want to solve them? And then instruct the agency. Give the agency a clear direction on where to go. I think that would be actually a good approach for Congress to take. And on the notion of FCC authority, you know, Chairman Copps and I think Chairman Martin recently. Oh, I'm sorry, Commissioner Copps. Wishful thinking. Personal, not company. Commissioner Copps. I thought you'd like that. Commissioner Copps and Chairman Martin have both said recently they think they have all the authority they need to prevent network operators from going about things or going or doing behaving in a nefarious way against applications providers.
But Greg's company has to take a little bit of the blame for the hot and heavy and the rush, because they want national franchise authority. That to them is the golden carrot, and that's why you're seeing a rush here. I think you're absolutely right. This is an issue that needs consideration, a lot of education. It's taken the pro-net neutrality forces a long time, I would say 6-7 months, to get to the point where, you know, members are really starting to understand it. I think we need a little bit more time, but there's this desire to get the national video franchise. In my mind, there's no way a national video franchise bill should go without enforceable net neutrality, and we are actually supportive on the national video franchise. But to the extent that some people say, oh, let the national video franchise go and we'll do net neutrality later. Yeah, and I've got a patch of land in Arizona and desert I want to sell you. So it's just one can't go without the other.
Sorry, you look at the FCC.
Yes.
Again, if you could speak up a little bit, please.
Worked at the FCC, Chairman Powell. Didn't he put out
Didn't he put out comments on this issue, like 4 years ago?
Yeah, what we did. And what we did was establish some very, very high-level principles. But this was several years ago. And all really Gigi and I are saying is let's update that with a fifth non-discrimination principle. Then we feel like openness and innovation would grow on the net. But the four principles that you're referring to...
But you had the power to do that.
It was a policy statement. It was a simple expression. It was an aspirational, we hope that the market goes in this direction. It lacked a legal grounding. It was, as I said, an aspirational goal.
But you want more than the fifth policy.
No, we want the fifth principle, and it should say, if you're a network operator, you may not discriminate on the basis of source or ownership. It's as simple as that.
But those 4 points were then backed up by Chairman Martin's policy statement.
In a merger condition that only applies to two companies in this market.
Yes, but then it reinforced the thought and the policy from one chairman to the next, didn't it?
It did. Okay. It did. And that's one of the few areas of consistency, I think,
exactly,
between administrations.
So the FCC hasn't proven that it's watching this issue. It continues to watch this issue.
It's sort of watching it like this. It's watching with one eye closed because it's only got its eye on the people that are coming to them as a merger partner.
So that's not right.
This is coming to you. Admittedly, someone who lobbied on that issue, I lobbied Chris on this issue. And what you said back then was there's no there there. There's no harm. That has never happened in stock. But there's nothing there.
And so the thing to keep in mind is that that was before the major telco CEOs said we're going to impose this two-tiered internet and these discriminatory charges on websites.
Okay. Let me just address the issue of, well, why don't we wait and see if bad things happen? And you know, I'm sorry, I got to take a pot shot once again at the cable industry. Because, you know, yes, this was some years ago, but you know, one of your members banned virtual private networks. Another one of your members limited streaming video to 10 minutes. So you guys don't exactly have clean hands. But here's what I fear will happen if you just take the let's wait and see approach. This is a letter from the National Telecommunications Cooperative Association. And they fear that if there's net neutrality regulations, that vital resources, which would have been spent on network upgrades, could be diverted to re-engineering networks to meet non-discriminatory requirements. And that's what you're going to hear. If you wait and see, people will build their networks to be discriminatory. And that's what Cisco is selling. That's what Alcatel is selling. You wait, you discriminate, all of a sudden everybody gets up in arms, and guess what the companies are going to say to you? My God, we just spent millions and billions of dollars to build these discriminatory networks, and now you're telling us we have to, you know, re-engineer them to be non-discriminatory?
You know, what Gigi calls discrimination...
And then to Mike. Second.
Sure. What Gigi calls discrimination, we would call differentiation. If there are... And what I mean by that is, if there are five or six content providers out there, they all want different things from us. Some people might want security. Some people might want bandwidth. Some people might want to sign up with a joint marketing agreement. Some people might want to pay on a per-download basis. They all want to do different things. And what Gigi says, a non-discrimination principle says that we can't do what every other company in the marketplace does. We can't customize our contracts. We want to sell to everybody. When you're running a network, you don't make money negotiating exclusive deals. You make money selling to everyone who wants to buy capacity from you, because that's the only way Verizon makes money. We sell capacity. We don't sell anything else. So we want to sell to as many people as possible. We just want to be able to structure our contracts in a way that our customers want, and different customers want different contracts. The non-discrimination provision which Gigi has and which Chris is advocating would literally subject us to liability for having a different contractual agreement with Viacom than with Disney than with Hallmark. Now, why would you do that? And how does that incent us to build the new functions to enter that market?
I think Mike got the pot shot, so I'm going to let him respond.
Well, let me just respond to the pot shot. All right, virtual private.
I love you,
virtual
Mike.
Private networks. You know what virtual private networks are? That's when we use Citrix or whatever it is to get into our email and our computers at the office from home using a home computer. And there were some of the earliest days of cable operators internet service agreements with customers that said, and you know, you can't use a virtual private network on this on the network, because somebody thought, I don't know if it was ever enforced, but somebody thought this could be a problem here, and it was a problem. I'm the regulatory guy for the brunt of that, because people came in and said, you see, they're discriminating against virtual private networks. We tried to figure out why we would do that. But I went down and I talked to some of the technical guys to figure out, why did this happen? Is this some sort of business judgment? We're trying to make money somewhere else on this? Maybe somebody was, but what I found out was that somebody put that in there, in some of the agreements at least, because they figured out that at that time, to do a virtual private network, you needed something called a static IP address. As opposed to what we normally provided people, and the quality of service would not work with VPNs. We'd have all kinds of problems. Somebody put that in the agreement for that reason. This is a good example. I don't know whether that was a necessary agreement or not a necessary agreement. I don't know if it had some potential discriminatory impact or not, but it was an example of our industry trying to build and grow a new business that was good for our customers, and trying to figure out how it works technologically. This is still very, very new technology, and it's evolving all the time. So for every example like virtual private networks that are thrown out as if it's something we're doing for some sinister reason, I have to, because I'm the one who's going to have to answer these things, go down and find out, is that why we're doing it, or is there some good technological reason? And until you are quite certain, or even have a good base for suspicion that there's something sinister going on and there's some market failure here, our guys get apoplectic about the idea that they can't continue to think about how best to build this network to make it work for customers without some regulatory overlay that says you can't do this and you can't do that.
Okay. We have room for one last question, so please make it good. No pressure.
Competition.
Good question. Good job. Just repeat really quick. Just repeat quickly for the cameras. If you create a company on the web and you don't have to pay Verizon or Comcast in most cases to deliver it, unless you're using them as a provider to that, you get the same service from end to end to customer, regardless of who you are. But if you get to a regime where you have to pay extra for the highest tier of service to get to that potential customer, haven't we violated something here?
Who gets to go first, Greg or me?
It sounds like that's directed to Greg.
Danny, I think that's a great question, and I think just the opposite is true. If you were going to start your own search engine tomorrow, if you came up with some fabulous way to compete with Google, you couldn't provide the same quality of service they do. As Chris said, Google spends hundreds of millions of dollars setting up server farms and connecting right onto the backbone so that consumers who access Google can have a much better experience than you could ever provide starting your own company. Google also will cache, which means they will place their content in regions around the country so that when you access Google, you can go to a local server and get content much faster. Danny's search engine probably couldn't afford to do that. Google has other ways of just spending lots of money to provide a quality of service that you couldn't do if you started this on your own. One thing you might be able to do to compete with Google is you might be able to reach a commercial agreement with a network operator where you could actually provide a quality of service that's somewhere close to what the others can do, spending hundreds of millions of dollars on server farms and caching and other things. And I think, frankly, that's one of the main reasons why the Googles of the world are spending so much money on net neutrality. I mean, these are companies, Microsoft, I guess, is one example, that haven't always cared about garage companies, let's say. But I think it's fair to say that they're doing what most companies do in the public policy arena, which is they're legislating to some degree to achieve business goals. And one way to achieve a business goal is to make sure that Danny's website, Danny's search engine, cannot reach that same level of quality of service as Google. And one way you would do that is through agreement with a commercial operator.
Okay.
This is an argument that I'm going to try to stay calm about this, because it's a little hard for us to be lectured about what sort of entrepreneurial companies, how they act on the Internet. My company was started in a basement in London. If we got into a world of a two-tiered Internet, think about what that would mean for a small company who's trying to reach a global audience of Internet users. This is a picture of the Internet, okay? This little bit down here is AOL, okay? If that company in the center in London wants to offer this service to everybody on the Internet, what does that mean? That means deals with every incumbent where we land traffic in India, in China, in America. You break the end-to-end principle that the Internet was built on when you talk about a two-tiered Internet, and you create barriers to entry into the market for things like free phone service that shouldn't exist.
But you only create a barrier to entry if people can't go to www.dannyswebsite.com. Because once a consumer can buy a Verizon product at 5 megabits or 15 megabits and 30 megabits, and go to your website at the speed they purchase, and they are guaranteed to be able to get to your website, and they don't have to pay extra to get there, and you don't have to pay extra for them to get there, then as long as you maintain that world, which is the world we live in today, and what the House bill addresses without the Markey Amendment, then...
Here's the difference between the world we live in today and the world that Greg imagines, okay, and his company imagines. It's eBay's or Skype's choice whether they want to purchase, you know, caching services.
Exclusive deals, which would foreclose Dan's new website.
But there's no legal prohibition on us from doing that today, as far as I know, and we're not. Well, that SBC has Yahoo. They have a portal, for example. SBC has with Yahoo, the great promoter of net neutrality, and we have actually MSN, where they have a it's a joint marketing agreement actually, where if you sign up with Verizon or you sign up with AT&T, you can choose for your portal to be Yahoo, and you can go right to Yahoo, or you can choose MSN. So there are things like that. But on the notion of the exclusive content provider, the exclusive financial institution, I mean, technically we could do that today. It would be commercially suicidal to do that, because we wouldn't really make money if we started selling, you know, if we're not spending billions of dollars on a network, essentially, to create all this new functionality to create all this new ability to provide security and provide reliability and provide connectivity and provide privacy so we can sell to one person in each area.
Okay,
we want to be able to sell to everybody. That's the investment we're making, is to do that.
And I think Mike gets the last word.
Well, I don't know if this is the last word, but the world as we know it today, there's an assumption here sometimes that without any fast lanes, without any differentiation of how internet content gets to the home, everybody survives just fine, and the world is great, and consumers have a great experience from it. But these things don't just happen of their own. Without a fast lane, new services that devour a lot of bandwidth begin to crowd the bandwidth that's available to the home and grab for it. Peer-to-peer, I think I mentioned that before, has a way of gobbling up available bandwidth and making it very difficult for some of the video streaming services or music services or other high intensive bandwidth services to be provided at the same quality that consumers want it to be at. If people can just keep putting stuff out on the internet with no concern about efficiency of bandwidth use, the internet gets clogged. It's a technological problem as well as an economic problem. You can't just a lot of this discussion assumes, like, well, assume a network and then let's see how we should regulate it.
Okay.
The network doesn't build itself. It's got to be adapted to the uses that are out there.
Okay, that's the last word. I want to thank, I don't envy you, any of you, your tasks for talking to your members, but good luck and thank you for your attention.